All right, what we're going to do now is that we're going to move away from individual eschatology, issues of heaven and hell and so on, and we're going to deal now with what's called general eschatology. That's what's usually meant when people talk about eschatology or the doctrine of the last things. They're talking about how things will end up. How do we interpret the prophecy of Scripture? What about the consummation of all things, the second coming of Christ, the millennium, and things like this? And so that's what we're going to be moving on to. And, of course, this is going to take up the bulk of the rest of this course, because there is so much material to get through. Now, as I've said before, when it was written, much of the Bible was eschatological or was prophetic. And of course, there is an eschatological strain that runs through Scripture from creation all the way through to final redemption and glorification. And it's very important for us to understand this, that there is an eschatological issue that's always involved. The idea of redemption involves eschatology. The idea of God's getting his glory from all of his creatures involves an eschatology. The idea of the doing away of sin and of the wicked and of the defeat of Satan involves an eschatology. And so you cannot consider theology without considering eschatology. It's built into Christian theology. And for that reason, of course, eschatology needs to be taught not as something that is tacked on to the end of systematic theology and something that's not really important, something that we can say, well, it all will pan out in the end. No, we must understand that eschatology is involved with every aspect of systematic theology that we have been involved in these courses. With the doctrine of the person of God, well, of course, God himself has created all things for his glory. God himself is a personal, a relational God. And therefore, the fulfillment and perfection of the relationship that he wants with his creation is an eschatological fulfillment. It was even in the Garden of Eden, where Adam was given a mandate to go and perfect what God had made. It was, of course, made perfect, but it was not perfected. It was not matured. There was work to be done. As far as the revelation of God is concerned, well, of course, revelation is nothing more than communication from God to man. And at its core, it demands the correct response from man, the creature. And the correct response is worship, an understanding worship from both heart and mind. Now, of course, that's not something that God gets very much of, and hasn't got very much of for thousands of years. But at the end of time, all things will come together, and in our sin-released state, we will understand what it is to glorify God. We will understand that we were made to verbalize the glory of God and the glory of his works back to him. And so that, of course, involves an eschatology. And then, of course, our sin, our fall, our corruption, our pollution. Well, of course, if we are to be anything but damned for what we are, then there needs to be a fixing and restoration of what we are and of the curse that has been put upon the world. And therefore, that involves a redemption, which, of course, involves a future glorification, a future resurrection, a new heavens and a new earth eventually, a reign of God in the hearts and minds of his people that is not half-heartedly accepted by his people, but is fully realized to its full potential. And so the fall and the redemption of man And of course, the final glory of God and of his Christ is involved in eschatology. And then, of course, we're part of the church, Christ's bride. Now, at the moment, we're not married to Christ. We are betrothed to Christ. And so, to be married to Christ, the church needs to be completed and presented to Christ at a future day. It involves an eschatology. And then, of course, there are the great promises to the nation of Israel as well, which involve an eschatology. Their cleansing and their establishment as the head and not the tail of the nations. And so we understand that the doctrine of biblical eschatology is important to get right, and it's important always not to treat it as many people treat it, as something that takes up all of their time and is thought of independently from the gospel and independently from the purposes of the triune God. No, it is the thing that caps off systematic theology, that caps off our worldview and everything that God made us for. And so I want you to keep that in mind as we move forward. I want you to keep in mind the other departments of systematic theology. We won't have much time to deal with that, but I will try to introduce these other aspects and relate them to eschatology as we go through. Having said that, there is so much to go through. Sadly, there is an awful lot of error that has to be exposed, that has to be explained, and that has to be refuted. And so we'll have to be doing quite a lot of that as we run through this, as well as, of course, presenting the positive case for what I believe is the Bible's presentation of the last things. Now let me explain to you how I intend to do this, at least in this first part of our examination of systems of general eschatology. That is that I want to say something about the relationship of biblical prophecy to time, because there are different approaches of Christians to eschatology and time. And I think it's perhaps helpful for us to start there, at least to have that in mind. You are going to find it a little bit confusing, I have to admit. It confuses me. Nevertheless, I think it's important to have certain things under our belts before we move forward. So I'm going to be talking in this lecture about the four different relationships of prophecy to time. These four different outlooks are called historicism, preterism, futurism, and idealism. And so we're going to be looking at those four approaches. After that, in another lecture, I'm going to be talking about the parameters of meaning in the interpretation of the Bible, and particularly the interpretation of biblical prophecy. And so I'm going to say a word about hermeneutics, about the interpretation of prophecy. That will take up another aspect, maybe another lecture or two. Then I'm going to move on to deal with the two major theological umbrella systems of theology. And they are covenant theology and dispensational theology. I'm going to use those general terms, and we'll examine what they are and how they affect one's interpretation of the end times. Once we've done that, I'm going to move on to what I think is a very important and often neglected aspect of eschatology, and that is the biblical covenants. I'm going to talk about the covenantal structure of the Bible. I'll be dealing with what I believe are unbiblical theological covenants, which are employed by covenant theologians and sometimes by dispensationalists, before looking at the biblical covenants in some detail. That will take up a lot of the rest of this course. Not all of it, there's much more to come after that, but that is where we're going in this next part of our examination of the doctrine of the last things. And so to kick us off here, I want to give a quotation from Thomas Ice, one of my former teachers, and his article on the interpretative views of the Book of Revelation in the book The Dictionary of Premillennial Theology, edited by Mal Couch. And Dr. Ice says this, quote, "One of the most important but seemingly little recognized aspects of proper interpretation of the Book of Revelation and all Bible prophecy is the role of timing. When will prophecy be fulfilled in history? There are four possibilities. The four views are simple in the sense that they reflect the only four possibilities in relation to time: past, present, future, and timeless. The preterist, or past, view of interpretation believes that most, if not all, prophecy has already been fulfilled, usually in relation to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. The historicist, those that believe that there is a present relation of prophecy to time, sees much of the current church age as equal to the tribulation period. Thus, prophecy has been and will be fulfilled during the current church age. Futurists, who look to the future for the fulfillment of much prophecy, believe that virtually all prophetic events will not occur in the current church age, but will take place in the future tribulation, second coming, or millennium. The idealist, who believes there is no real relationship of these prophecies to time, believes that the Bible does not indicate the timing of events, and that we cannot determine their timing in advance. Therefore, idealists think that prophetic passages mainly teach great ideas or truths about God to be applied regardless of timing." End quote. And so, we have four basic approaches to the prophetic teaching of Scripture. Preterism, which believes that prophecy has been fulfilled or mainly fulfilled. There are three kinds of preterists. Now, the older preterists tended to be liberal in their interpretation. And we'll be dealing with all of these views, by the way, in more detail. But the older preterists believed that the Book of Revelation predicted the fall of the Roman Empire in the 5th century AD. And most of the people that had that view were liberals in their interpretation of Scripture. And therefore, they believed that there was just an error in the way that the biblical writers saw the future. Modern preterism, though, has two forms. Full preterists, who believe that all of prophecy has been fulfilled, and that we are living in the new heavens and the new earth, and that Christ has returned and all of that. Full preterists, people like John Noe and J. Stuart Russell and others, are really, I believe, heretics, because they have no room in their system for final glorification and the results of the application of the merits of the cross of Christ and all of that means for humanity and for the rest of creation. But then there are partial preterists, and there's quite a lot of partial preterists. People like R.C. Sproul and Greg Barnson and Kenneth Gentry. These are partial preterists, and we will be looking at their work in a little bit more detail later on. These have been gaining in popularity over the last 10 or 20 years, and there's quite a lot of partial preterists around in evangelicalism today. So preterism is the first approach. Partial preterists, by the way, believe that most of the Book of Revelation was fulfilled in AD 70. Because of that, they believed the Book of Revelation had to be written before AD 70. therefore, they have a number of things that they have to establish in order to promote their views. Then we have historicism. Historicists are those who, as the name implies, look at history, church history, and they find fulfillment of these prophecies in the church age. Historicists tend to be date setters. Many of them believe that the tribulation started when Constantine was converted at the beginning of the 4th century AD. Thus they interpret much of prophecy, and of course much of the book of Revelation, in terms of the unfolding of church history. Now, historicists are like the preterists in the fact that both systems emphasize historical fulfillment in church history. Although, of course, preterists have curtailed it to the 1st century, or the older preterists to at least the 5th century, whereas historicists believe that certain happenings in church history are predicted in the book of Revelation and in other passages. Thus, as Dennis Johnson writes in his amillennial commentary on the book of Revelation, called Triumph of the Lamb, page 353, quote, "Historicism can plausibly claim to read Revelation quite straightforwardly as a series of sequential visions that symbolize, in order, the sequence of events that span the history of the church, from John's date to the second coming, millennium, last judgment, and the eternal state." End quote. A little further down, he writes, "For example, commentators belonging to the Church of Rome during the late Middle Ages typically identified the emergence of the beast from the sea, Revelation 13, as the rise of Islam. Protestant theologians during the Reformation typically interpreted the harlot Babylon, Revelation 17, as the Roman Church and its papacy, which persecuted the defenders of the true gospel. Some historicists viewed the locusts released from the abyss with the sounding of the fifth trumpet, Revelation 9:7, as the Muslim invasions of Europe. Jonathan Edwards was persuaded that he lived in the time between the sixth and the seventh bowls, Revelation 16, and that the seventh bowl would be poured out in the 19th century." End quote. So as you can see from this, historicists are date setters. Historicists identify certain dates with certain fulfillment, and therefore they naturally look to certain dates in the future for fulfillment of biblical passages. The Seventh-day Adventists are perhaps the greatest exponents of historicism in our day. It's not widely held by many people today, but the Seventh-day Adventists are certainly historicists in their interpretations of prophecy. Now, after preterists, who interpret much prophecy as past, and historicists, who look for fulfillment in the ongoing present, you have futurists, who say that much prophecy, and certainly all of prophecy that deals with the end times, is yet future. And so futurists believe that much is still to be fulfilled. Thomas Ice writes, for example, "The Reformation brought a return to a study of the sources. In Northern Europe, those sources included the early church writers and aided in a renewal of the study of prophecy from a futurist perspective within the Roman Catholic and then the Protestant churches. The Jesuit Francisco Ribera, who died in 1591, was one of the first to revive an undeveloped form of futurism around 1580. Because of the dominance of historicism, futurism made virtually no headway in Protestantism until the 1820s through Church of England scholar S.R. Maitland in 1826. In the late 1820s, futurism began to gain converts and grow in the British Isles, often motivated by a revived interest in God's plan for Israel. During this time, it gained one of its most influential converts in John Nelson Darby. Through Darby and other Brethren expositors, Futurism spread to America and throughout the evangelical and later the fundamentalist world. The last 150 years have seen, for the first time, the full development of consistent futurism. End quote. The fourth view of the interpretation of prophecy and of the book of Revelation is the idealist view. The idealist view says that prophetic events are not meant to be viewed in relationship to time at all. Dennis Johnson, whose book Triumph of the Lamb I've already quoted, who is an idealist, writes on page 360 of his book, "Idealism is sometimes called iterism or recapitulationism because it interprets Revelation as a series of repeated symbolic pictures of the church's struggle from John's day until the second coming, the last judgment, and the eternal state." Now, let me interject here that you might think, well, that means it's historicism then. But let me read on. "Thus, Revelation offers multiple images that provide different perspectives on the same great warfare, sometimes in terms of its behind-the-scenes heavenly sources, and at other times in terms of their visible, earthly outworking in the experience of churches, countries, and cultures. Unlike the other three schools, idealism does not rest its interpretation of specific visions or specific features within the visions on an attempt to link these details in Revelation with specific events between the two comings of Christ. Thus, while idealism agrees with historicism over against futurism and preterism that the visions symbolize the conditions confronting the church throughout the entire church age, idealists part company with historicists' efforts to locate the judgment symbolized in the fourth seal or the fifth trumpet at a particular point in world history." Johnson then notes that Augustine was the earliest known idealist interpreter of Revelation on page 361. And let me add to this the words in the article "Idealist View of Revelation" in the Dictionary of Biblical Prophecy and End Times by Hayes, Duval, and Pate, pages 205 and 206. Listen to what they say. "The idealist approach sees Revelation as a symbolic description of the ongoing battle between God and evil. Rather than predicting future events, Revelation offers timeless spiritual truths to inspire Christians of all times as they endure persecution, suffering, and injustice at the hands of God's enemies. This view gained ground through the allegorical method of interpretation promoted by church fathers such as Origen and Clement. Coupled with the amillennialism of Augustine, the idealist view became the dominant approach to Revelation from several hundred years after Christ until the Protestant Reformation." And so you have these four views: past, present, future, timeless, or preterism, historicism, futurism, idealism. There's also a fifth, if you want to add to the confusion, and that is eclecticism, which is not surprising in our age, and that is views that try to take all four positions and say there are truths in all of them. Now, personally, I don't believe that the term eclecticism is very helpful when it comes to the interpretation of prophecy. While it is true that people like Craig Keener and Greg Beale and Dennis Johnson do try to take to heart some of the things that preterists and historicists and even occasionally futurists say, for the most part, these people are idealists. Likewise, to lump people like George Eldon Ladd and Grant Osborne into eclecticists is not very helpful. These guys tend to be, as we will see, premillennial, although not dispensational premillennial, and therefore they are more futurist than they are eclecticist. So we'll not talk about eclecticism, even though the writings of many scholars today who are not dispensational premillennial do borrow from aspects of all four views, especially from idealism and historicism, sometimes a bit from preterism, and occasionally, but rarely, from futurism. Now, if your head is spinning because of what I've just taught, then I invite you to look at the diagram that I've put out for you this week on the Veritas site. And on that diagram, you'll see that it gets even messier. The problem is, many historicists, for example, may adopt a preterist interpretation of the Olivet Discourse, Matthew 24 and 25, Mark 13, and therefore say that it has been fulfilled, but will not interpret the book of Revelation in a preterist way. So therefore, you can be a historicist, but have a preterist view of certain prophetic passages. Also, you can be a futurist, believing that much of prophecy is still to be fulfilled, but still adopt historicist views of what's going on in the world. Thus, they interpret the Bible by the newspaper. And so there are many that would call themselves premillennial and even dispensational that will go date-setting. For example, Donald Gray Barnhouse identified Mussolini as being the Antichrist. People tried to identify Mikhail Gorbachev of being the Antichrist. There are people that thought the year 2000 would be the time for the second coming of Christ. And people interpreting the word generation in the Olivet Discourse as meaning that Christ must return by a certain time. And so these people have introduced aspects of historicism into their futurism. Even good dispensational scholars like John Walvoord have been guilty of this. Now, many futurists, particularly if they are dispensational premillennial, can be caught adopting historicist interpretations in their views of the seven churches in Revelation chapters 2 and 3. An example of this is Arno C. Gaberline's commentary on Revelation, where he writes on page 33, quote, "The seven churches represent the entire church on earth, and the conditions of these seven churches foreshadow the different periods of the church on earth from the apostolic times to the ending days when the Lord calls his saints to meet him in the air." End quote. And you'll see the same kind of thing in Clarence Larkin's commentary on Revelation and in many others. And here you can see that they're adopting a historicist interpretation of chapters 2 and 3 of Revelation. This is not a futurist view, it's a historicist view. And historicism does creep into certain futurist interpretations. So you can see that there is some inconsistency in some interpreters, and only certain preterists or historicists or futurists are actually consistent in holding those views. We try to be consistent in our futurism. We believe that there is much prophecy in Scripture, both Old and New Testaments, which has yet to find fulfillment and will find fulfillment in the last days or in the end times, the consummation of the plan of God in history. And so we reject the identification of the seven churches in the book of Revelation as being representative of certain phases of church history. We think that that's a very fanciful and unwarranted interpretation. Now, before I close this lecture, I want to confuse you even more, although I hope that in the end this will actually provide a means of clarification as we move forward. I first want to mention or talk about how these four views of the relationship of prophecy to time, and particularly the book of Revelation to time, mesh with the different millennial approaches that we will be studying. You may have heard of the different approaches to millennialism, the issue of the millennium. You may have heard of premillennialists and amillennialists and postmillennialists. But what you need to be aware of is that a person can be a preterist amillennialist, like Jay Adams, or they can be a preterist postmillennialist, like Greg Barnson or Kenneth Gentry. A person can be a historicist premillennialist, like many premillennialists were in the 18th and 19th centuries. People like Robert Murray McShane and C.H. Spurgeon and people like that would be historicist premillennialists. There are quite a few historicist premillennialists who are covenant theologians. People like George Eldon Ladd, for example, would be historicist premillennialists, although you will not find many of the most fanciful historicist interpretations in Ladd's covenant premillennialism. And then you can be a historicist postmillennialist, like Jonathan Edwards and Martin Luther. Many of the reformers would fall into this camp. And then you can be a futurist who has certain preterist interpretations, say of the Olivet Discourse, but not of the Book of Revelation, or of the Book of Revelation and not the Olivet Discourse. You can be a futurist, as we've seen, who can also have historicist views. Then you can be a futurist who is a premillennialist, and George Eldon Ladd would also fit into that category. But you can be a futurist who is an amillennialist, like Kim Riddlebarger, or someone like that, because you believe that there's quite a lot of prophecy still to be fulfilled. Anthony Herkimer would be another one like that. And then you can also be a futurist who's a postmillennialist, for the same reasons. You believe there is much to be fulfilled. If you are an idealist, you can be either an idealist amillennialist, like Dennis Johnson, or you can be an idealist postmillennialist. And so you can see, when you mix the approaches to time with the approaches to the millennium, things can get a bit more confusing. And this is why many modern commentators, like G.K. Beale, Grant Osborne, George Eldon Ladd, Dennis Johnson, Vern Poitras, and many others, even though they might differ on certain interpretations, some may be more historicist, some may be more idealist, some may be more futurist, in the main, their interpretations of the Book of Revelation tend to overlap quite significantly. The main reason for this is that they are adopting a very similar interpretation of prophecy. The only school of thought that is really outside of the modern approach are the dispensational premillennialists, who, of course, are futurists. And that will be the position that we will be setting forward in the rest of this course. So I apologize for introducing general eschatology with all of these different terms, and then showing that they can be mixed, and showing they can be mixed further with the different millennial views. But I think this will start to look more clear to you as we interact with different texts and different interpretations in the rest of the course.